with these Bible study format services, and we'll do a little variation here. There'll be some interaction as we move forward. So if you have a notebook handy, and or if you're one who takes notes somewhere on your phone or anything, we're going to make use of that. Daniel 5 puts us squarely back in modern-day Israel. If it helps, we happen to be three decades since Nebuchadnezzar has issued a proclamation to his empire, if you remember in Daniel 4. And that decree we then read in that entire chapter of Daniel 4, it represents the only writing of a foreign king offered in Scripture, whether you know it or not. It's in that proclamation that Nebuchadnezzar confesses that the true God was the one that made Nebuchadnezzar, not many of us can admit this, a beast for 7 years. He was out of the kingdom, and in this case, he suffered the consequence of his own arrogance and had to pay a price over 7 years of being beast-like. The king highlights what he learns from the experience by then making the following statement three times in the book of Daniel. And if you're there, it happens to show up in three separate verses. Even as I'm in Daniel 4, I'm going to backtrack here. I'm going to read what's in verse 17. Or forgive me here. I'm looking. Oh, here it is. This decision is by the decree of the watchers. I'm in Daniel 4, verse 17. And the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know. And here's the phrase that shows up multiple times that Nebuchadnezzar is inspired to write, that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowliest of men. And this statement is then made two more times in this chapter. It's a nice reminder of what comes through, lessons that come through here in this chapter. If you go to the back end, we'll read the last statement that he makes in verse 37 to get some closure. It offers this. Now, I, Nebuchadnezzar, this is a sign-off, almost like a signature. I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride, he is able to abase. You may have a little indicator here that says that's the word humble as well. And so what we find is, again, Nebuchadnezzar being reminded of how he had, by God's hand, the ability to rule, and then that was taken away from him for a long duration, and then at a given point, it was restored. When we arrive at Daniel 5, then, Belshazzar, and in all indications, the term son is going to be used, but the term ancestry is more accurate by most commentaries, which gives us a sense that it, in all likelihood, it was not his son, it was his grandson, if it helps. But Belshazzar is now king, even as we move forward. Belshazzar has happened to have lived in the amidst all the grandeur, the greatness of Babylon. He's aware of Babylon as not only a great city, but as a great empire. And he knows the people of Babylon to be great, a conquering people, one that's lasted in this empire now 90 years. He knows of Nebuchadnezzar's conquest, when in all likelihood this was his grandfather. Belshazzar also knows of the proclamation by his grandfather. He's well aware that in this case, even through the proclamation, that Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged that God was the one who put him in power and who also took away his power then for a period of time and then restored that power. So we see that here. Belshazzar also knows something interesting even as we get to chapter 5. He knows that his enemy, a conquering power, the Persians, are right outside his gate. They're camped there. And interestingly enough, given Babylon's supremacy over a long period of time, he thinks nothing of this, which is remarkable. Why would he think nothing of this? Well, if you remember by background, even as we talked about how the city was made up, the city was fortified in most cases by two walls, in some cases, three walls. So I've given you a modern day map, even as you can see up on both screens. If I go forward, and I'll make sure I click here, you can see in part the time period, the biblical time period, Jerusalem over here, and I'm on another screen. Here, I'll go to the screen that most of us are looking at. Jerusalem's over here, and then if you look over here, here's Babylon. Baghdad would be up here if we get a sense for perspective and direction in terms of what's here. And if you remember, and I happen to have noted this, you're going to get title along the way. We'll revisit that a little bit later. It's helpful to note that the city of Babylon was on the Euphrates. You may remember that somewhere. It's stored in your memory. This is a picture of that Euphrates in right now in Iraq. This gives us some sense of the scope and the greatness of this river, which it was known for. Depending on where you are today, there's some areas that have are much less dominant in terms of waterway, but that said, you can certainly see that there's a major waterway there. This happens to be historically, it's a modern day view of some of the restoration of that city, but if we go backwards, there's the Ishtar Gate, which is in Berlin. You can still go see that, even it's been reconstructed there. This gives us a much fuller sense of what this city is like, if you remember, as we revisit it. City roughly around 200,000. Most commentaries note this. Most Bible helps note this. City about the size of New York City, two-thirds the size of New York City. Forgive me, I'll qualify that. Most would say more equivalent to Chicago. How they come up with that, I don't know. But as you can begin to see, this is a pretty impressive city. In fact, it was the dominant power of the time. So why would Belshazzar not have any fear of an opposing army, one who'd been conquering other nations, other countries, other kingdoms up to that point? Why would he have no fear of that? Well, we've already talked through, in some cases, these walls, these series of walls that were oftentimes there. And if I only revisit just for a moment what these walls entailed, in most cases, in most parts of the city, there were at least two walls, in some instances, three. So how does that then play out? Well, the exterior wall was right around 22 feet wide of brick and masonry, which they would tell you oftentimes you could run two chariots down those walls. Then they had a space between the first wall and the second wall, which was roughly equivalent to 40 feet. And then you would have a second wall that was of equal thickness, 25 feet. And then in many parts of the city, there was now an additional space. And then there was a third wall of 12 feet. Now, the reason why I note in a cautionary way that there were three walls in all parts of the city, because in some instances, there was actually water after the second wall. So if you went over or you made it past the second wall, you were going to wind up in water and they would still kill you. In most of those instances, historically, that space between those walls, they acknowledged as kill zones. So you got to love this. If for whatever reason you were a country that could get past the first wall, you would usually face arrows raining down on you, boulders thrown on you, or there would be hot grease, hot oil poured over the top of you. And many of their enemies didn't dare breach those walls. So if you'd made it through the first wall and you got to the second, you would ultimately wind up either in water of great depth, or you would wind up suffering the same punishment. As I even shared, it was interesting, even architecturally, that at no point did they create walls where the entrance was directly from one wall to the next. They would oftentimes offset walls so that you could not go from the outside of the city to the interior of the city in one direct path. They would force you to veer off, and you couldn't do so rapidly. So they had thought through all of that. So even as we get a sense for what this city was like, we might also note that even as you can see here, there were these towers that were always available, were always there. They would contend that most of those towers were 9 stories high. There were as many as 360 watchtowers around the city. So you couldn't do anything without them seeing it by and large. And if that wasn't enough to kind of create confidence in Belshazzar, they knew, enough food to last years. That was not an issue. And in terms of water, they had the mighty Euphrates to drink from. So there was never a question about them dealing with issues. Sometimes enemies would come, opposing armies would come, and they would, in essence, cut off everything. Hey, it didn't affect, in this case, Babylon at all. They weren't worried about this. Well, even as we get a sense for what's here, Belshazzar then believed that, in essence, his empire was invincible, that there would be nothing that could bring it down. And given that background, then, we're going to look at Daniel 5 today, and we're going to go through only 31 verses. It's not long, but in this case, it's in a 31 important verses that certainly God offers along the lines of Daniel's life that's helpful for us to go through and pick out some lessons that God provides. Here's where I'm going to ask that you do a little bit of work on your own, and I'm going to have two different segments of time, even in this Bible study, that I'm going to task you with something. It won't take you long. I'll ask if you have a notebook handy, even as I did before, that you pull that notebook out. I'll give you some directions. I'm going to give each of us a task. You'll do the task first, and then you're going to share the information that you wind up writing. You bullet in short and quick form on your page or on your phone. You'll wind up talking with someone else about this information. So to give us a little bit of context, here's task one in terms of our Bible study. I'm going to ask that you complete the following exercise in two steps, even as I shared. First, you're going to answer some questions on your own. And then secondly, after that, you're going to wind up sharing those questions with someone else. So here's the very first question that I pose. It's only going to take you about 2 minutes to do this. It won't take you long. Again, I'm going to have you choose in this case, either by background, Daniel 1 from either chapter 1, Daniel chapter 1, Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 3, or Daniel chapter 4. And ask that you will, based upon your memory in terms of those first four chapters, that you simply summarize what takes place in that chapter. So you might be, wherever you're sitting, you might be taking Daniel chapter 2 and the person beside you, Daniel chapter 3, and the person over to your, I don't know, left, Daniel chapter 1. All I'm going to ask that you do is in about 2 minutes in brainstorming fashion, that you bullet by choosing a chapter what takes place in that chapter. And then what you can't see, even as you get some hypertext here, once you do that, I'll have you answer a second question, which on the bottom, number 2, actually says, once you bullet quickly what happens in that chapter, I'm asking you to pick out one lesson from that chapter that resonates with you, that applies to you, that you use or what anyone could use from that chapter. So this is only a 2-minute exercise. It happens very fast. If you will, I trust you have notes out and I have a timer going. Here we go. I'll give you 2 minutes. Go. Okay, that's 1 minute. You have 1 minute more to go. Again, recreate, summarize what's in that chapter, and pull one lesson of importance that comes from the chapter you've chosen. Okay, we go about another 20, 25 seconds. Okay, that's 2 minutes. Not going to take long. So you have, I trust, on paper, on your phone, somewhere there, you have a chapter chosen. And at the same time, you have some summary. So this is what I'm going to ask you to do. It's, again, another two-minute exercise. It doesn't take long. We might, you know, go as far, go crazy here, go 3 minutes. But I'm going to have you turn to someone and now share what chapter you chose. Do a quick summary of your chapter and a quick lesson that was learned there. And we'll only do this for about two and a half minutes, and then I'll pull you all back in. Okay, 2.5 minutes. We'll go 2 minutes here. On your mark, get set, go. You're going to turn to someone and share. What chapter did you choose and what lesson did you identify? If you have someone behind you that's alone, by all means, draw that person in and share your information with him or her. Let me give you another minute. Okay, let's go 15 seconds and then I'll pull everyone back in. Okay, if you will, and we'll run this exercise a little bit later in the Bible study again. Again, it gives us an opportunity to connect with one another at the same time, start focusing on the content that we're dealing with. So if I may, let's go show of hands to get a sense for what we wound up choosing. How many of us chose Daniel 1? Can you go show of hands? Okay, how many of us chose Daniel 2? Several there. How many of us chose Daniel 3? Okay, fewer. Anyone go back to Daniel 4 that we just covered? A few. We had some who did. If I may, could I have someone just briefly, within several sentences, share from Daniel 1 what it was that you noted? Will you share this with the room? Can I get a hand? Everyone's like, I'm not about to talk. Are you kidding? I need one person, if you will. Yeah, please, Mike, will you? Yes, sir. Do so.
chapter one is the introduction so that we know who all the players are and what have you. So just skipping quickly to verse 17, it says these four men had all of the knowledge and skill and all the learning and wisdom, and God gave it to them. In verse 20, it says, in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times more knowledgeable than the magi or even the enchanters were in all of the realm. That means that they know the mystery of God. That means when you fast forward to the fiery furnace questions, and you'll notice Daniel's not there, you realize that they can have that arrogance and that confidence because they know whether they live or not, they're going to be resurrected. And that's the confidence we have.
Yeah. Okay, good summary. Obviously, very knowledgeable. The confidence that you noted there, important to underscore. Again, as a reminder, I'm only going to reinforce what you said. These were young guys, 16 to 18 years old, which is just remarkable when you think about this. So thank you for that. Daniel 2, can I get someone to run a quick summary of Daniel 2? So again, one of those instances where like, I'm not saying anything. Mr. Ost, please, would you stand and share? Thank you, sir. Yes, sir, that's good.
Daniel 2 has to do with, get down to the times of the Gentiles, has to do with the statue of a man, which was of Nebuchadnezzar, because he was a head of gold. There were four parts of gold, which is, of course, Babylon and silver, who was Medo-Persian, and they're all in succession. All the way to the toes. Third is Greece, having to do with the bronze, and four has to do with the iron. We're not done with that yet. So God was preparing, since the Israelites refused to honor him and obey him, and do it as his nation, chosen nation, he's appointed the Gentiles. And he's used them and will until the very end. It's a great lesson for Israel in the future, because they'll see what actually happened. So, and Nebuchadnezzar learned a great lesson in the whole process.
No, it's good. Thank you, sir. Very nice. Again, times of the Gentiles. This is a shameless promo for Tuesday night's Bible study. We tackle that there. So thank you, Mr. Oss. Let's deal with Daniel 3. Someone summarize Daniel 3. Are you good here? I'm curious. Go. Daniel 3. Daniel 3. Tell us about Daniel 3. Unbelievable. I don't think I could have done better there. Way to go. And we know, only as a reminder here, whereas chapters 1 and 2 were roughly, again, late teens, maybe early 20s by the time we get here. At that point, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which is noted there, would have been about 35 to 40. So we're getting a timeline, a series of points. Excellent job there. Unbelievable. Anyone take Daniel 4? Daniel 4. Did I have anyone that wanted to re-summarize or summarize Daniel 4 again? None. Okay, so I'm going to trust that what I did there was sufficient. If it helps, when you get to Daniel 4, if you remember that we covered in the intro, another decade has passed. So this would have put Daniel at about 50 at that time. During that duration, we know whenever Daniel was come to interpret that of those that decade, 7 years would have been a time period that Nebuchadnezzar would have not been king. So Daniel, in all likelihood, would have played a central role in government for Babylon. He would have been an instrumental in making sure that everything worked efficiently, even while the king was a beast for a while, which then takes us up to Daniel 5. And Daniel 5, as I've already shared, only has for us 31 verses. I need to insert a couple of things before we start reading in Daniel 5, verse 1. One is, we already know that the Persian king Cyrus is outside the gates. His army is outside the gates. We know that he again has been conquering nations, peoples, countries up to the point of Babylon. Babylon is kind of the cherry on the top of the cake. It's the big empire that he wants to take down. We also know that his series of conquests have been historically unfolding for about 10 years. So there's a long legacy of his successes along the way. Along these lines, Belshazzar, even as we know, is familiar with him, but he certainly doesn't pay any credence to the idea that the Persian Empire is out there, their army is out there, that the Medes are connected with them. He doesn't really pay credence with that. If we're going to break down Daniel 5 just quickly into three sections, I offer it this way, and there are a number of different ways you can tackle this. I would say part one for us deals principally with this idolatrous feast. It is a party. And we can come up with any word for what's going on here, but he's going to party to the pagan gods. And we'll see that in verses 1 through 9. Verse 10, we're going to go into the middle section, which is a little bit longer. Daniel's going to be called out of retirement, if it helps, because he was not playing a prominent role at the time. In fact, Belshazzar acts like he kind of hears of him, but doesn't know who this individual is. Bring him out of mothballs. We'll have him interpret what's going on. Verses 10 to 29. And then lastly, there are just two verses where even as Daniel is inspired to deal with the writing that's involved to make sense of it, that writing sadly is going to come to fruition, whatever the meaning of that message is. So as we move into this, Daniel, believe it or not, now at this point is 30 years ahead. He is 80 years old. Most commentaries will say that. In all likelihood, he would have been at a lesser role in the kingdom. We don't know what that role is. We just know that he didn't have the role of prominence he'd had under Nebuchadnezzar. So even as we get there, he's been in government. He's familiar with government. He well knows over Nebuchadnezzar's reign that the empire had been strong, that nothing had been able to defeat them, that they had been extensively successful in all conquerings. And again, the empire is about 90 years old by all indications. Okay, if you're with me, let's go Daniel 5, verse 1. Belshazzar. Now, by background, the name Belshazzar it sounds like Belteshazzar, doesn't it? It sounds kind of close to his name. We were having a discussion even after services in Buford today about, well, what's involved here? Well, we know that this notion of Bel happened to have been like Baal, a pagan deity. The name Belshazzar, if you look up in many commentaries, is this notion of protected by a pagan deity, which Belteshazzar, which is Daniel's name, if you go back to Daniel 1, it's very close. Wouldn't be a surprise that there were similarities. Beyond that, we don't necessarily know of anything more. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. So we have to just pause long enough. He has a conquering foe outside his walls, and he says, you know what we need? We need to party. We need to party hard. And in essence, that's what he does. And at a given point, whether inebriated or not, he chooses to take this up a level, a direction that God is not pleased. Well, he tasted the wine. Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar, again, we would believe that this is his grandfather based upon lineage, had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem. So he knew of these things. Now, we're not necessarily sure in all likelihood if they were on display. Several artists' renderings gave the indication that they would have been oftentimes in a certain location. But if you were to, you know, kind of walk a Hall of Fame conquest, that it might have been there. But he knew of these things. And so he says, go get those items that were in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Again, by background, he's bringing in wives, plural, concubines, plural. Bring them all in. We're going to have you watch us do this. And then you're going to join in the festivities. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the kings and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. So I played with some artist renderings. Moody Bible Institute actually has a series of images that may help illustrate in your mind what this might have looked like. One way or another, again, he brings in 1,000 of these different lords, of those who have to be kind of high up in the kingdom. And he says, what we need to do is we need to not only have this party, but we need to bring out these holy vessels. Now, again, these are some archaeological finds. I'm not going to make an argument about if those are the exact same ones, but you get a sense for what's here. It takes us to verse 5. In the same hour, even while this party is going on, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw part of the hand that wrote. So amidst all that they were doing, all of a sudden a hand comes out. Now, again, artist renderings, Moody provides this. I went to a couple of additional sources. I got a little crazy here. This actually is a Rembrandt painting, which gives us license to show this, to give us a fuller sense of what he might have seen. This happens to be a separate artist rendering. I'll show you, they highlight up here. This is an outdoor temple, which may have been the case. These would have been words written by hand up here. And then we begin to see everyone's reaction, even on the right-hand side. The king's countenance then changed. I'm in verse 6. And his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. And the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers, bring in all the wise individuals. And the king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. If you go and get a sense for, again, historically, well, why wasn't he given two? Why wasn't he given the second most? Most commentators will tell you that there must have been some in lineage, a second party by family. It may have been his father, we don't know this, who happened to have been prominent, but may have been out in terms of conquering other lands or traveling abroad. But there, in this case, he said he was going to recognize and honor anyone who could read this writing so that they would immediately become third in the kingdom. Now, all the king's wise men came and they stood and they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. So depending on the source, and I was interested, I don't remember even seeing some of this in our Bible commentary. I need to acknowledge that I'd gone there and read some of that. Many will note that in all likelihood, this could have been Aramaic without consonants. Who knows necessarily why those who happen to be wise in the kingdom weren't able to read this, but they could not. There was some along the lines, if you read by history, that the letters themselves and consonants would have been placed in such a way that this would make sense. That my gut instinct, even as we were talking this morning, is might this have been Hebrew? Well, we don't get that necessarily from historians. Thereby, it would make sense in part that Daniel, being from Jerusalem, might have been able to read this and others hadn't. But by speculation, the preponderance of thought is that this was Aramaic. And the Aramaic makes sense when you begin to go in, even our Bible commentary knows this, because there are numerical breakdowns that allow interpretation along those lines. Verse 9 then reads this way, then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. They were perplexed. They came up there and looked. Now, commentaries will give a range of responses here. I think sometimes we can read this, and it might seem like water off a duck's back, like it's not that big of a deal. This was a big deal. Belshazzar, as they noted, even as he got these image or these items from the temple, he was in essence snubbing his nose at God. He was besmirching God. He did not care about God. This was a way of kind of saying, in your face, God, I can do whatever I want and I don't care. as we read through the story, we see him go from cheerful and happy and kind of a party, jovial atmosphere to, in many cases, it would say that physiologically, he would have been almost thrown into shock. He would have been perspiring heavily. In some commentaries, it would say that he was not able to hold his bowels. That's what this is about. Because he didn't even know how to respond here, and necessarily no one else did. And so even as he made sense of all of this, he's trying to make sense of all of this, he was obviously really thrown by what he saw this, what he saw here. Okay, this takes us then to the second section, beginning in verse 10, which I've entitled, Daniel Interprets God's Message. Then the queen. Now, we need to stop long enough to recognize what's been said so far. It's noted by background that his wives were involved, and yet we don't get a designation with the wives being the queen. Most commentaries will tell you that by queen, this in all likelihood would have been either his mom or his grandmother, who would have been established as queen still, however that works in terms of her holding that office. Because she would at the same time have known about Daniel. For whatever reason, Belshazzar didn't cross his mind about what do I do when all my wisest men can't figure out what this writing is. But someone's going to come along and say, we've got a problem. Verse 10, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. And the queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever, which was standard vernacular, standard language to be honoring of the king. But then this second statement can be interpreted a number of different ways. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There was a pause here. And what most commentaries will say, that in essence, as she came, grandmother or grandmother, she said, get a hold of yourself. You're the king. What in the world are you doing? You're a mess right now. Pull it together. You're actually over the empire. Don't show the fear you're showing. So she asks him to kind of reel it in. And then she has an ace in the hole. Verse 11, there's a man in your kingdom in whom the spirit of the holy God, is that telling? That keeps showing up in Daniel's book. The spirit who has the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. The king Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So it's a quick resume, better than LinkedIn. She said, this guy's really credible. He's done amazing things in the past. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, she goes back to this notion of who he is and what he represents, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, there's the name again, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. And so what we find here again is a reminder, this notion of Daniel's reputation. Even as you've shared with me, and we've been in terms of a summary of background, this was a guy who had a strong reputation from young age, 18, 20, through his 40s, through his 50s, and now at 80, he's still acknowledged for these same qualities. He's still acknowledged as a man with God's spirit. People refer to him this way. They recall and think about him in this light. Verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel? So he must have known about this reputation. He must have known this history here. Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father, the king, brought from Judah? Again, that notion of father is along the lines of, in fact, you may have as much your ancestor or ancestry. Verse 14, I've heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men and the astrologers have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give an interpretation to the king. Again, were they unfamiliar maybe with the Aramaic? Were they unfamiliar with what was there? We don't know. We just know that for whatever reason, there was no insight. Even as the writing was on the wall, they couldn't read this. Verse 16, I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed. We're going to give you a lot of nice stuff, and we're going to make you high in the kingdom. You shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold. We're going to bling you out around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. And notice Daniel's character in all of this. He is not thrown by any of this. In fact, he actually is going to wind up saying, I don't need your stuff. Verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. And then he goes into this. O king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, your ancestry, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. We just went through that idea a little bit earlier. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. He was authority appointed by God. He was allowed latitude to do what he could, what he needed to do. Shy of, in his braggadocio way, saying, look what I've built. God said, hold up, push pause. You haven't done anything. I've allowed you to do this. It's a good reminder here of that. So even as we drop down, verse 20, but when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, this reminder of his grandfather, Belshazzar, remember what your grandfather, what happened? He was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. And here's a nice reminder of where it went. Then he was driven from the sons of men, his heart. He was driven from the sons of men. Excuse me, get a comma in there. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was like the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. God is in charge. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all of this. Now, if you remember back a chapter, I would only pause momentarily. Again, it's probably helpful to remember Daniel's a little bit older. In all likelihood, he knows of Belshazzar. He doesn't know him personally in the same way that he knew Nebuchadnezzar. You remember back in the last chapter, even with Nebuchadnezzar's words, that Nebuchadnezzar shares, even with that account, that at a given point, once Nebuchadnezzar shared the account of him becoming a beast, remember how Daniel reacted? He paused. He was like, I can't believe I'm about to tell you this, because you're about to become a beast. Now, this is a different instance. Daniel's older. In all likelihood, the king's younger. We know that. And Daniel has probably been watching what Belshazzar has been doing over the last number of years in terms of reigning. If you go look at his reign, not a good king. We don't gather here that in this case, Daniel even paused in sharing what was here. We certainly don't get the same reaction in scripture that we got in Daniel 4. And so what he says here is, you had opportunity to be educated in what was right. You knew of the true God. You would have been through the finest schools in the palace. You would have been taught what took place, and you would have known that your grandfather, by all counts, wound up being made an animal for 7 years. And this hasn't fazed you. That should be a warning for you. Verse 23, and you've lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron, wood and stone. While you do not see or hear or know, And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. You had opportunity in this case to learn from your predecessors, from your ancestors, from your grandfather, and from those who went before you, and you chose not to learn. Boy, if this is not a lesson for second and third generation Christians, even as we get here, as we go through this section, it's a nice reminder of the importance of learning from others. Verse 24, then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, that being God, and his writing was written, and this is the inscription that was written. Again, this is familiar territory for many of us. Meeny, meeny, tinkle, you farson. And he interprets it then here. Without any hesitance, he rolls through what this means. Verse 26, this is the interpretation of each word. Meeny, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. So you may have numerical indicators here in terms of, I have 50 shekels in verse 26. I have a shekel in verse 37. If we make our way down, what he winds up doing in Aramaic is he actually gives you a series of terms that refer to lacking the character that he needed to have at this point. And so he tells you what this all means, even as he makes sense of it all. So we're in 26. God has numbered your kingdom and it is finished. And I see here, and I have no idea. I have a semicolon in my Bible. There's a part of me here that just wants to put an exclamation mark because it's going to translate into an exclamation mark here in a second. Tikal, verse 27 reads, and you've been weighed in the palaces and found wanting. You come up short. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So he actually says here, whether you know it or not, you had fair warning well in advance to know what to do that was right, and you chose not to do it. In fact, you not only chose not to do it, you chose to snub your nose at the great God by pulling those holy vessels from Jerusalem and drinking out of them and making mockery and light of God. Verse 29, then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. He acted on that promise that was made. What we then find, no surprise, is Belshazzar chooses to kind of throw money at it. Go find me the right person, bring him in. I'm going to trust that this is right, that the individual is going to be able to explain this. And through all of it, what he winds up learning is indeed he is, his heart being lifted up was haughty, that he was self-serving. And sadly, not only was he self-serving, but he was dismissive of the true God, despite the fact he'd come in contact with him. You know, what's interesting here is there are a couple of places in Scripture that remind us of the importance of what's here. Leave a marker. Let's go over to Isaiah 44 and 45. Believe it or not, there are sections of Scripture that remind us, and this is well pointed out in the UCG Bible commentary, that talk about the prophesying of this taking place. Isaiah was inspired to know by background that Cyrus indeed would do this, that he would come in and he would take Babylon. You can go to the book of Isaiah and we see what Isaiah the prophet is inspired to write. And we won't read up through verse 7, verses 1 through 7 are key to this, but it says the following, thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus. So God uses, time of Gentiles, God uses Gentile kings at times in certain ways as he sees fit. It kind of reminds me sometimes, and I don't know if anyone ever played, when we were kids, I wasn't really good at Risk. We had a Risk board at home. You'd get out Risk, you'd put the people all over the board, and then you'd do the best you can. Kind of sheepishly, I'd try and play Risk and do the best I can. Never really knowing the rules, kind of making it up as we go. I'm reminded of that, and I only draw that in here because I think it's helpful, at least in terms of our own thinking, to recognize God oversees all of it. Whatever it might be. I may have some Risk pros in the room. I was not that guy. Better at Stratego, okay at Connect Four, terrible at Risk. But that said, it helped at least to understand how God sees all of this. He recognizes these patterns. He puts in place who he wants in place, and he removes who he wants. And so even as we see this, he wants Cyrus involved. To Cyrus, whose hand I have held, to subdue nations before him and to loose the armor of kings, to open before him the double doors so that all gates will not be shut. And you can read this whole section, and certainly I would encourage you to, on your own time, this notion, even as you get, as you drop down, he says, at a given point, I will make sure that you are able to do what you want. Verse 5, I'll pick up. I'm the Lord, and there's no other. There's no God besides me. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none beside me. I'm the Lord, and there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I'm the peace and create calamity. I, the Lord, do all these things. He says, I'm going to use this section, Cyrus as an instrument. Why in the world this might not have gotten through to Belshazzar, we don't know. Interestingly, if you back up, even in chapter 44, it also talks about, in this case, about God using certain instruments in certain ways. And if you drop down, there's an interesting series of verses that even happens in verses 27 and 28 of the previous chapter. It says this, who says to the deep, be dry? That would be God. And I will dry up your rivers. Now that's kind of telling. That's kind of a funny phrase that shows up there, even as Isaiah is inspired to write. And we go, well, what's the relevance there? Well, we'll get to the relevance in a moment. Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. He designates Cyrus. And he shall perform all my pleasure. Whatever I have him do, he'll do that thing. Even saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple, your foundation shall be laid. Whatever I desire Cyrus to do, whatever it might be, I'll have him do it. Okay, by background, what we then find is then prophetically, Cyrus is a key figure here, known in advance before the downfall of Babylon. If we're back then in Daniel 5, let's just hit a couple of verses even as we end. The last section, interestingly enough, tells us even as Daniel was inspired to go and see Meeni, Meeni, Tekel, Upharsin and explain it, and everyone is in awe, and Belshazzar says, you know what we need to do? Get a robe on this guy. Put the gold chain around his neck. Bring him in. He's now third in the temple. Think about this. This is all within a short period of time, not even 24 hours. Verse 30, Daniel's prediction comes true. That very night, the king of the Chaldeans was slain. And then it offers this. And Darius, the Mede, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Okay, so what did we just read? Whether you know it or not, even as Daniel was inspired to come in and say, the kingdom is no longer yours, he didn't live till sunset or sunrise. That prophecy, that insight that he was given, it came to fruition that night. I'll go and read a couple of sections from a couple of different sources. Noted here, the last hours of the Babylonian Empire happened to have been on October 12th, 539 BC. Interestingly enough, that would have been the third day of the Feast of Tabernacles that year. The Greek author Herodotus said this, hereupon the Persians, who had been left for the purpose of Babylon by the riverside, entered the stream. Remember what we just read in Isaiah? Because it doesn't tell us here how that kingdom falls. How is Belshazzar wiped out that night and the empire is completely overtaken? Hereupon the Persians, who have been left for the purpose at Babylon by the riverside, entered the stream. So let's go back to history. If you get some sense of what's here, whether you know this or not, the Persians chose not to go through those walls, not to risk being in those kill zones. They wound up diverting the Euphrates. They actually diverted the water away so that the soldiers, the army, could slide into the city unbeknownst to anyone. They came in the city without anyone knowing, with all the wisest in the midst of a party. Herodotus actually goes forward from there. That water had now sunk to reach about midway up a man's thigh and thus got into town. Had the Babylonians been aware of what Cyrus was about, or they noticed their danger, they would have never allowed the Persians to enter the city, but would have destroyed them utterly. For they would have made fast all the street gates. They would have reinforced the gates to make sure that everything was fine. Some commentaries will even indicate that even as they had, in certain cases, maybe porous blockades, so you couldn't go through, they would have reinforced that. And they would have put their warriors on either side so that no one would be able to come in. It offers this, for they would have made fast all the street gates, which gave up upon the river, and mounting upon the walls along both sides of the stream would have caught the enemy as if it were a trap. But the Persians, in this case, came by surprise. The city, the empire, was taken without resistance by Gubara, commander of the Persian army. Probably butchered his name by pronunciation. Before sunrise, Belshazzar was dead. 2 weeks later, Cyrus entered the city. He forbade destruction. He appointed Gubara governor and left the religious and civil administration of Babylon unchanged. And what we then find is after 90 years, it's over. That head of gold has now gone. And sure enough, prophetically, when we're back in Daniel 2, it goes to the Medes and the Persians. It winds up being divided up. So that said, even as we make sense of this, this was a king that didn't have a chance. I say that he had a chance. He had, by background, enough lessons, enough knowledge in order to act. And he chose not to. Which then leads me, as we come to the conclusion of this chapter, to me tasking you with a second thing here. So I'm going to ask you to do the following, even as we get to this latter end of Daniel 5. I'm asking you to do two things. I'll give you, again, 2 minutes. Exercise is going to be very similar to what we had before. In 2 minutes, I'm going to ask you to do the following on your own first, if you will, and I'll read what's here. Identify one main lesson that you gained, that you gleaned, that you understood, that you benefited from this chapter. And then in just 2 minutes, bulleted items. We're not getting fancy here, not fancy narrative. Then after 2 minutes, well, even within that 2 minutes, I ask, if you will, to please, if other verses come to mind, bring those other verses to mind. If you're making a statement about, say, leadership, where are other verses that you can go to support that point that's learned through this section of Scripture? So I'm going to give you two and a half minutes to do this. And then at that point, you're going to share that lesson with the person that you spoke with before on the first go-around, and we'll share lessons. Okay, you're on the clock. 2 minutes, go. Go one more minute. Let's go about 25 more seconds. Okay, if you will, now you're going to turn to whomever you spoke with earlier, and you're going to share what lesson you learned here. And then also, if you have a verse or two of support, share that verse with that individual near you. I'll give you another two and a half minutes. Go. So let me give you about one more minute. Okay, let's go like 10 more seconds and then we'll wrap up. Okay. If you will, I'm just curious, and we did this morning. Granted, it was with fewer people. We happened to have about 20, as I shared, over at Buford. What kind of lessons did we come up with? Anyone share a lesson that you pick up in Daniel 5 and you're willing to share? Please. Sarah.
The biggest lesson for me was right when you said it resonated with me, was when Daniel was told he'd be given all these wonderful things if he could say what this meant. And he was very clear, right? He didn't want that. It was from God. And that's what he messed with. What you said was, it just isn't Daniel. It's not us. It's God. It really resonated with me because in my own life, I have to consistently think of that. It's God doing it through me. It's not me doing it. And then examples throughout the Bible were plentiful. I mean, Christ himself said it wasn't him. It was Christ. It was God doing it through him. But then when Mike and I were talking, we were talking about how the Israelites went out of Egypt with a heavy hand, right? They were celebrating, like it was them who had done something, but it wasn't God was upset with them, but it was he who had done it for them.
Yeah, a good, powerful lesson for all of us. On several counts there, even as you reference back, good scriptural support that we provide there, even with the example of Israel leaving Egypt. A good lesson. Anyone else? Another here. Someone else, a lesson that comes to mind. Mr. Ost, you're on. Did you go? Yeah, I saw your hand, and then I saw Christine Talbot after you.
There's a lot of beautiful lessons in there. One of the lessons, I thought about God's plan of salvation, which he already knows how it's going to be laid out, that human beings will do their own will, and God has his will that's going to be done. And I got to thinking about how even Jesus Christ, that his divine height before he was taken, prayed and asked God to maybe pass the cup from him. And then he kept saying, your will be done, not mine. So this here is the brilliant doctrine, and it's not going to be moved. And what he's already said in the past is as secure and assured as possible, and he never varies. So we can have a great deal of faith and be absolutely sure, no matter what looks on the surface, no matter if we're persecuted, that God's will is going to be done, and he'll never leave forsake us.
Yep. Valuable lesson for all of us. God will never leave or forsake us. Mrs. Talbot, Christine.
Are you here? Talbot.
Sorry.
No, I think because I talked about the first question, I use Daniel 4, that's humble. And then also our same thing, like they both suffered from not being humble. Not only that, because of the audacity to think things are higher than God. And so that's been a lesson to us, we know our place.
Yeah. Powerful perspective even there. I'm going to play off of what I came to in terms of some lessons that I take. If you're with me in Daniel 5, and I read this a little bit slowly, even on the latter end of verse 23, remember these words as I was able to share with you and you were reading along, which do you see or hear or know? And the God who held your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Certainly, there are two things at least that stick out for me, but most importantly here, this notion of God owning everything. I don't oftentimes think about the fact that God owns my next breath. That's kind of what he says. He owns everything that we have. I'm reminded of what's in Hebrews 2, verse 10, that only offers reinforcement here. Everything belongs to God. It's all hymns, all his. And it says, it finishes that verse, and all things were created by God. I'll go over to, I'll make reference to Psalm 24, verse 1. Psalm 24, verse 1. If you don't make the trip, I'll do a quick read here. The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein. In other words, everything is God's. We can come up with our own sense of importance. We can become self-absorbed as though we do whatever it might be that's great. In actuality, God allows us to do that, but everything is God's. Everything is God's. And so that's what I take here. For a second lesson I have here, I think this is telling, and maybe this is me as a third-generation Christian picking up something here, even as I was reading verse 22. If you back up one verse, this sticks out for me. But you, his son Belshazzar, speaking of what had taken place with Nebuchadnezzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all of this. Now, that raises an important question just for me. I know that many of us are baptized, and I know that we make that commitment to God with the recognition and understanding that we have committed contractually to God, and God, we're always going to reap the benefit of that. It raises a separate issue here, even as you read this, that are we obligated to follow what we know of, even though we might not be baptized? Whoa, that's a heavy one. Well, in this case, Belshazzar was. He had to have known of his grandfather's experience, and yet he was held to a standard of knowing he had to follow that and keep it. That's pretty a strong statement here. That said, even as we think about what that means, the importance, at least to me, is this idea, this principle of, am I obligated in knowing God, whatever it might be, to to uphold that standard, to follow that, to obey that? And the answer is yes. Any of us are. If we go backwards to Daniel 4, verse 30 and 31, by background, Nebuchadnezzar knew the charge against him. He knew that if he became arrogant, that it would all be taken from him. And we can read in verse 31 or 30 and 31 that the moment he says, look at all I've done, God says, hold up. You had the knowledge to not be self-serving, to not be superior about what it is. I'm going to still hold you accountable. And the consequence was 7 years. I'll take us over to, well, there are a couple of places in the Gospels that at least came to me. Luke 12, I'll go over there. I'll just read two verses on the tail end of a parable that's here. And this idea that even as we know God's truth, are we obligated to keep it? Yeah, we are. I'm in Luke 12. I'll only read verses 47 and 48. Luke 12, verse 47. This notion, this passage deals with the faithful steward. Even as Peter had asked this question about what are we obligated to do? And Christ responds in 42 about, well, when you know these things, again, being reminded here that they hadn't even been baptized, that God's Spirit hadn't been given to them, he says, you have a responsibility still to do this stuff. And as we drop down, verse 47, and that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. In other words, you don't avoid the consequence simply in ignorance. It doesn't work that way. You can't claim ignorance in this. What God gives, his divine word, is powerful, and it applies to everyone, whether we like that or not. 48 reads this way, but he who did not know yet committed things worthy of stripes shall be beaten with few. You're still responsible for what you know. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required, and to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more. So even as we make sense of what's here and what's in Daniel 5, is it's quick to say, well, why in the world would he feel like Belshazzar is responsible for knowing about Nebuchadnezzar, his grandfather? Well, God says that's how it works, that knowledge requires belief and action. That's what I take from this section of scripture. The last thing that's helpful, and this is going to be one of those things where I throw homework your way, even as you have opportunity, because I'm not going to have you read but we will certainly encourage you on your own time to do so, is you can't take lightly a warning. And I take it from the previous chapter and this chapter too. Even as you're here in Daniel 5, I'll make mention of verses 16 and 17, it's this notion that he knew, despite the greatness of the empire, he still had a responsibility to do something about it. Now, I pause long enough to think about this. And we oftentimes, as a church, have been pointed about recognizing that even the blessings that God gives this nation can be taken away. So I share here, even as we understand our country and the nation, it's the direction it's gone, even as the blessings that we long affirm about Israel and what God has provided this country, God can bring on a nation in a day complete collapse. An empire can end in a day. That's what I take from this section of scripture. When you have opportunity, I'll have you on your own time. Go and please read Ezekiel chapter 7, that prophecy. I'll let you pull the parallels between the Babylonian Empire and this nation today. And recognize that a country that snubs its nose at God, I turned off somehow there, that a country that snubs its nose at God, that opposes God, that does everything it can to erase any remnant of God, God's commandments of, in essence, go opposed to God, ultimately is waiting to be taken over. So even as we go forward, it is a reminder, and that principle holds whether you're an individual, whether you're a family, whether you're a business, whether you're a nation. It applies all the way across. Whether you're a church, it doesn't matter. When you snub your nose at God and you don't watch for the warnings, you don't pay attention to the warning, you risk a huge price. And so here, even as Ezekiel chapter 7 notes, it's helpful to recognize that God is ultimately the judge, that he's the one that brings fury. And he shows this over and over in Scripture. So it's a good reminder for us. Don't take lightly the warning. When you know something, it's our obligation to do that thing. Okay, so today we've done a bunch of stuff. And I got to think here. I'm going to trust that we're not going to go back to slides if we don't have to. We've been able to go backwards and get some sense of Daniel 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then we worked our way by verses, all 31 verses through Daniel 5. We drew some lessons from that. And then we set ourselves up for Daniel 6. If you get there, I'm not stealing the story. Daniel's going to be in the lion den post 80 years old. In going through all of this, it's really helpful to recognize that even as Daniel dealt with this king, Belshazzar, this was a pompous king that eventually God intervened by a message by his hand or by a hand, where he went from superior to immediately scared to death. It's a lesson I think we should all take from this section of Scripture. The interpretation we should take from this is that there in rebellion and disobedience, God has a limit. He'll let people go so long. He did this with Nebuchadnezzar. He'll did that with Belshazzar. He does it with us. If we're rebellious to him, eventually the hammer falls. So it's a good kind of humbling experience to recognize that even as we have opportunity to go to him and turn and be repentant and change a direction, that God allows all of that. That said, there's a wonderful warning here. It's a lesson that we can all take as an individual, as a church, as a nation, to honor God, to make sure that we not take lightly the warning. Let's not miss the meaning of Daniel 5. It's a powerful one, and it's a timeless message for us all.